Wolf Whistle, the fiction of Lewis Norden, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for part two in a series of programs for Black History Month 1994. Lewis Norden is here to read from and talk about his latest novel, Wolf Whistle.
Emmett Till was a 14-year-old boy who lived in Chicago with his mother, and he came to visit in the South in Mississippi Delta, where I lived, very near to my home, in fact, and he whistled at a white woman in a country store. And for that whistle, he was taken out by two men and tortured and murdered. And those two men were tried by a jury of their peers, 12 white men from Mississippi. This was in 1955, and they were let go scot-free, even though they had admitted in Look magazine that they did the murder.
Writer Lewis Norden, his new novel is Wolf Whistle, a fictional retelling of a true story of race and violence. Lewis Norden will be back in just a moment to read from and talk about his new book. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. In one of the bleak moments of America's struggle with its racial inheritance, a black teenager named Emmett Till was murdered in the Mississippi Delta in the summer of 1955. Because he had whistled at a white woman, Emmett Till was beaten and lynched. Although the two white men who killed him were acquitted, their trial became the object of national attention and helped to inspire the civil rights movement. Emmett Till's death also had a profound impact on the life of another Mississippi youngster. That summer, Lewis Norden was 15 years old, lived near the place where Emmett Till was murdered, and even knew his killers. Now, nearly 40 years later, Lewis Norden has retold the death of Emmett Till in a new novel entitled Wolf Whistle. Lewis Norden takes us on a grim journey to the heart of American racism. But his novel also presents us with unexpected dimensions of tenderness, compassion, even surrealistic comedy. Norden sets his story in Mississippi Delta places with names like Arrowcatcher, Balance Do, and Good Dog, Bad Dog. His characters have names like Bobo, Runt, Jeter Skeeter, and Rage Gage. He even offers us the narrative perspective of an ancient buzzard named Ross Barnett. Wolf Whistle tells an American tragedy, to be sure. But in the words of one reviewer, the book is also high comedy with a human face, not holier-than-thou satire. Lewis Norden is the author of three previous books. He teaches creative writing at the University of Pittsburgh. For Black History Month 1994, Lewis Norden is here now to read from and talk about his new novel, Wolf Whistle.
Alice was born again. She saw the ancient star rise over Bethlehem. She saw shepherds abiding, flocks and myrrh and miracles in the dunes. She saw what was unimaginable, classrooms in the swamp with black faces and white faces together singing jump down, turn around, pick a bale of cotton. She saw children holding hands with grown-ups, black and white, singing We Shall Overcome in long lines and in churches. She saw bombed out Montgomery, dead children, marchers in Selma, freedom riders in Jackson. She saw bombs flying over the miraculous desert, Baghdad burning, Emmett Till dead, Medgar Evers dead, Martin King, the little blue figure of her own stillborn child years hence, herself an abandoned child as well, names, faces, geographies not yet known to her, for in the extremity of her pain and need, linear time disappeared and became meaningless, blood running alongside lost hope in the streets of many nations. I was in a football locker room when I first heard the name Emmett Till. And some terrible jokes were being made about a black person who had been found in the river, tortured and murdered. And the football players in this locker room were smiling and laughing. And I was startled by the violence of these jokes, but I didn't know what to say. I don't remember exactly whether I was laughing myself, but there I was in this place. And suddenly, an old country boy, just like the rest of us, said, "You know, this ain't right. Laughing like this. A boy was killed and he was just like us for doing nothing. It don't matter what color he was. This is wrong."
Now there's the voice of conscience.
Exactly. And yet I know this boy's name, and he's now a 54-year-old man like myself, and I have not seen him in 35 or 40 years since this happened. And I think of him all the time. And in fact, I took those words into my own heart very quietly and secretly, and the locker room turned very silent, and nothing else was said. We began to continue to dress out for the practice, and I never forgot it. I began to make plans in some vague way to leave the South at that time, and I didn't talk with my friends about it. I didn't talk with my parents about it, but I began to think of the world as a very, very different place from the world that I had lived in.
It's a wonderful thing to think about how a novel becomes a form of personal genealogy, and yet that is essentially what we have here in the form of Wolf Whistle. To turn to something of a light note in our conversation, Buddy Norden, against the dark backdrop that generated Wolf Whistle, tell me about these wonderful places and people that you have invented for your novel. Arrowcatcher, Mississippi?
Right. Well, in one sense, this book is not just about this dark event. It's about an impressionistic vision of who I was and what the South was to me for all of my life, and especially in that summer. And it's also comic things and wild things and silly things. And so this book, despite its source, is a comic novel in some ways. It has an outrageous quality. Arrowcatcher, one night I couldn't sleep. I had insomnia. My wife says, "Honey, I have insomnia too, but I don't lose any sleep over it." So, but anyway, I had insomnia, couldn't sleep. I was up watching TV in the middle of the night, and a five-minute film came on public television about a man who could catch an arrow in the air. His friend would shoot an arrow at him, and he would grab it out of the air. And I thought, my God, that's like something they would do in Mississippi, only they would institutionalize it and make it a high school sport or whatever.
You've created a coach who is the head of the arrow catching
right.
team, and one reads this novel with this incredible doubleness. Well, should I believe this? Oh, come on. How much fun is this guy having with me as he retells the South, so to speak?
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of fan mail in which the question is asked, where can I learn arrow catching? And where can I see an arrow-catching event or whatever? And it's just a sport I made up from that five-minute moment on television.
Let's talk about some of the, in addition to Bobo, who is the nexus of this novel, and whose murder, out of whose murder the action springs. Let's talk about some of the other characters. Tell me about Alice Conroy and her uncle, Runt.
Well, let me think. Alice is named after my wife, whose name is Alicia, and Conroy was the name of a child that I really loved when I was a boy, who was ironic and strange even in the third grade. And when the teacher would ask a question and nobody knew the answer, she would say, "Well, that's awful that you don't know the answer to this question. The dumbest child in the room would know the answer to this question." And then she would make us vote on who was the dumbest child in the room. And this boy, whose name was Conroy, would always win the vote. And of course, he never would know the answer to the question. But he was funny about that. He didn't seem to be damaged in the way that I would have been. It was a form of child abuse, I think, you know, for her to do such an awful thing. But he has remained in my heart as an example of intrepidness, a person who could live on.
She is, after a fashion, the conscience in this book, is she not?
She's the moral center of the book, and so she's a fourth grade school teacher who takes her classes seriously and who wants to teach the little children in her fourth grade that the world is a large place, larger than Mississippi, larger than the Delta, and that it's a place in which learning and possibilities beyond their white trash existence may be derived. And she takes them on several bizarre field trips during the course of the book, one of which is to the sewage treatment plant and another to the Prince of Darkness funeral parlor to watch an embalming. And
now, where did you, let's pause on that for a moment. Where did the Prince of Darkness funeral parlor come from?
I met a funeral director in West Virginia one time years and years ago, who was known as the Prince of Darkness. I don't know why.
Now, do you realize what you're doing when you use names and places like this in your fiction? You are, after a fashion, you're confirming everybody's suspicion about what a crazy, loony place the South is. Obviously, you're aware of that risk, but what do you do with it?
It is a risk, and in fact, the risk extends beyond the nice way that you have just put it. It extends to the possibility of stereotype, and that I don't want to be accused of, and I'm very sensitive to that phrase, because I do believe that there's a certain amount of genuine fun in caricature and cartooning that is not stereotype. And that's what I hope to do, to write magical and cartoonish flashes into what is essentially realistic and serious fiction occasionally, and that does happen. And I don't think that it's so bad an idea to paint the South in this way, since what I'm really doing is painting a 15-year-old boy's impressions of the South. And to me, it was a magical and cartoonish place at times. And in another way, it's how I have dealt with the tragedies that occurred there in my life. New details about one thing and another came out in the newspaper every day. A federal judge was chosen, Durwood Swinger. The prosecutor was a local boy, a graduate of Arrowcatcher High. He had a deep limp from a case of polio when he was a child. He gave a little skip to his step when he walked. People who knew him called him Hopalong Cassidy because of that skip in his step. The paper even reported this. A New Orleans lawyer was named for the defense. Poindexter, Montbeclair could afford it. Solon Gregg was flying on Lord Montbeclair's coattails. The two defendants were being tried together, the papers said. Now that was a surprise, people said. It didn't look like Lord Montbeclair would want his name attached to the Gregg name in this public way, people said. Even if they did do the killing together, those people said. White trash like Gregg and a fine man like Lord Montbeclair? Well, my gracious, what won't they think of next?
Buddy Norton, who is it that tells us the story of Wolf Whistle? We have many voices at work in this novel. How about it?
I have worked many years to develop a first-person narrative voice that is serious and grown up and that also is able to speak in the language and heart of a small boy. And I had thought initially that when I wrote this book, it would find that reminiscent kind of voice that I'm comfortable with. But suddenly, as I began to write, I realized that the voice that was speaking this book was a voice of many ages and many races and many genders and many dialects and even many social and economic classes, so that as the voice begins to tell its story, it adapts itself to persons who are appearing in the geography and on the page.
I think it's a tribute to your ability as a writer to create this great variety of voices, and yet we don't get lost. We never really lose track of what is going on in Wolf Whistle. I mean, we hear and see things from the standpoint of, I don't know, dozens? Is that a
yeah,
fair characterization?
All right.
Many, many characters, and even the animals themselves. You also wrote a book called The Music of the Swamp, and you incorporate the voices of the critters, so to speak, into
your
fiction.
There's one moment in the story when two pigeons in the rafters have been taking a nap, and they see important events, and they begin to comment on them to each other, and they have a voice and a style of talking and a dialect of their own, which came as a complete surprise to me. I laughed out loud sitting at the computer looking into the screen as these two birds came on, and they themselves were characterized. There's also a flock of buzzards in the novel, one of which has a point of view moment of his own. And
Is this Ross Barnett?
Yes, this is the character Ross Barnett.
You've named him for a distinguished politician in the South.
Governor Ross Barnett was a governor in 1960, actually after these events take place, and so there's a bit of anachronism and magic in that too. This buzzard is named before the man who came onto the scene could have really had any influence.
Well, that's okay, because this buzzard not only looks forward, he looks back. He takes us back to the Civil War itself.
This buzzard is so old and so ancient and ugly that he dined on the Civil War dead.
What was the phrase that you used? The festival of...
Festival of Dead Rebels.
My goodness. That's morbid and funny at the same time.
Well, you know, I stayed with an old friend years ago on the battlefield in Gettysburg, and he was a park ranger living in a 17th century house on that battlefield, and he showed me a flock of buzzards. Buzzards lived to be very old, over 100 years old, and he showed me a flock of buzzards that contained flock members who actually had dined on the dead, who had eaten the corpses of the Confederate dead on the battlefield at Gettysburg. And that was a strange historical thing that stuck in my mind and that I put into the Mississippi wilderness.
Let's come back to the central events of your novel, Buddy Norden. It is Wolf Whistle. We're talking about an actual experience that you observed as a youngster in the South and that you have transformed imaginatively in your fiction, and that is the murder of Emmett Till. In your book, he goes by the name of Bobo. His killers are Solon Gregg and Poindexter Montburclair. Tell me about these two fascinating and pathetic characters.
I would never want to have it said of me that I made this hideous murderer, Solon Gregg, a sympathetic character in my book. I still feel a lot of personal rage and outrage about the murder of Emmett Till. I still am very much angry at what that did to me and what it did to all of us, and angry at a society out of which it grew and of which I was a part. And yet, as I wrote the book, I began to write moments in Solon Gregg's hideous life in which his own terrible background emerged, and in which his own terrible losses, especially of his son who tries to kill him by burning him up, accidentally burns up himself and dies. And I picture him momentarily at his son's bedside singing the only song he knows, which is about Little Bo Peep has lost her sheep. And I imagine him to be a human being, too, trapped in this society that I myself was trapped in as a child.
Buddy Norden, the other character who appears in your book and who is based on a real-life person who was responsible partially for the murder of Emmett Till, is an upper-class white gentleman. Are you talking to us here? Are you becoming something of a sociologist of the South when we talk about race and our sense of social station then as well as now?
None of my purpose had to do with sociology, although I concede that there is a sociological element there that derives from it. There is a social strata in the South and perhaps elsewhere that involves what Faulkner called the Compsons and the Snopeses, and that's what is happening here. One of the Compsons, who are evil in their way but moneyed, and who look down terribly on the Snopeses, chooses one of them to do his dirty deed, to murder one of the blacks, another social class. But in this book, there are actual social classes within the social classes.
Are you writing also, Buddy Norden, about the sexual codes of what used to be the South? And I take it, in some degree, still persists in what we call the South today. I mean, after all, the wolf whistle by a young black child, a young black boy, to a white woman is what generates the action of this book.
Right. That is crossing the social boundary that was uncrossable. To say a sexual word or to make a sexual gesture in some way across racial boundaries, even if it was a child, even if it was an outsider who did not understand the code and so on, it was intolerable, obviously, in this case. And perhaps in all cases it would have been.
This is what one of your reviewers has called the King Kong of racial taboos.
Yeah, I read that and I agree that that's true. It's the monster. It's the one that could never be crossed. And this is a book that's my book, and there are many books yet to be written about the Emmett Till case because there are many stories yet to be told. In one sense, I had to restrain myself from writing another book as I was writing this one, which was a book about gender and a book about what it means to whistle at a woman on a construction site or anything else, that is an offense. It is a considerable offense across gender, whether it had to do with race or not, and that there is a kind of a murderous feeling that might well rise up in somebody to be treated like meat or whatever in the way that men have treated women traditionally. That's not my book and not the book I'm to write, but I want someday to read the book about the Emmett Till case in which the woman's story is told, in which the black story is told, and the family story is told, and so many other stories that are yet to be told. But yes, there is a sociological thing about women and men in this story that is itself apart from blacks and whites. One time, one of these new boys brought a new axe handle with him to Red's good-looking bar and grow and dragged a straight-back chair out in the cinder parking lot and stood up on it with the axe handle and said, "Anybody who wants to get a hit over the head with a new axe handle, line up out here." Well, hell, who in his right mind would want to get hit over the head with an axe handle, is all Runt wanted to know. So Runt was pretty astonished when 7 or 8 of these boys went outside and got in line. This is the way they live their lives, Runt guessed. Seemed like to Runt, you couldn't live this way in a town where this thing had happened. So they lined up, these new boys. Each one took his turn. The boy on the chair hauled off and cracked each one over the head with the new axe handle, first one and then the next. It hurt, too. They seen stars. It'd like to knock a couple of the smaller boys out, it hurt so bad. One boy went down on his knees. He couldn't help it. Another one cracked like to paralyzed him. He walked back around and got in line a second time. You figure it out.
Buddy Norton, let me be a little bit contentious with you. What about the possibility that you're going to be accused of a kind of subtle racism, a white man who writes about this awful experience that black people experienced and that only they can appreciate? What about it?
It's a risk, and I knew it was a risk at the outset. I have never really written with my audience very thoroughly in my mind, and so it did not stop me from writing the book in any sense, and it didn't change anything that I wrote, but I knew that it was a risk. I knew that when Styron's Confessions of Nat Turner came out and he was criticized roundly for the very thing, that this book was far more modern and far more possible to raise these contentions. And in fact, I worried about whether it was true that there was some latent, strange, unknown racism in myself that was just dying to get out and say these vicious words and write these vicious things from the point of view of white races. But in the long run, this is a book for me, the book of my heart. It's a moral book, I think, and the book that I had to write, and in a way, the book that all my previous books were preparing me to write.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Buddy Norton. Do you think that books like Wolf Whistle, the imaginative efforts of writers such as yourself, who come to this terrible problem of race and racial relations in our country, do these books make any difference to the possibility, in the possibility of racial harmony?
I'm not much of a sociologist and don't know the answer to this question very well, though I do have a small glimmering that it might make a difference. I was on a television station program in Atlanta recently, and I began to talk about Emmett Till, and the entire audience of this program were black people, young, attractive, prosperous black people, and the announcer, the interviewer was a black man, and nobody in that audience had heard of Emmett Till.
My goodness, you talk, that's an awfully short memory, is it not?
It's unbelievable. Now, there was one young man who stood up. It was a station where the audience could participate. He stood at the mic to ask a question and said, I have heard of Emmett Till. I only recently heard of him, and I'm very interested in this. And I found myself giving out information to people that I thought might be insulted by my even pretending to know something about this thing that they knew about. And so in one sense, I hope, though I don't know for sure, I hope that there's an educational quality here or a benefit here that I had no idea was going to be there, and that I can tell the world about this moment that meant so much to international politics as well as to this own personal redneck country boy who experienced it, that they will know what I know.
Well, Buddy Norton, I want to thank you so much for coming by the National Humanities Center. Let me tell our listeners about you and your book. The book is Wolf Whistle. It's available from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. You are Lewis Norton. You're a professor of creative writing at the University of Pittsburgh. I want you to know that I admire the book. I admire you and what you're up to in this book, and I wish you well in your work.
Thank you so much.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like to have an audio cassette of this week's show. My guest was novelist Lewis Norton. His new book is Wolf Whistle, published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. For an audio tape of this program, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 698. That's program number 698. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Include $5 if you'd like to have a complete catalog of Soundings discussions available on audio cassettes. Over the next 2 weeks, Soundings for Black History Month 1994 will continue. Join me for conversations featuring scholars from UNC Chapel Hill, Princeton, Colgate, Harvard, and North Carolina Central Universities. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.